listeners. Hello, Ammo.
Hi.
So, as you can see by the title, we're covering some examples of death and grief in video games today, something that a lot of you have requested that we discuss.
Yep, we covered comic books and video games for this season. Can you tell I had more input this time around?
Well, speaking of input, I want to start this episode off with a recent gaming memory of mine. It's actually a core memory I have of our friendship as well, Ammo.
But see, I always get nervous when people talk about memories with me. Look, if it's a bad one, I didn't do it. It was my evil twin, Sammo.
Oh, you or Sammo didn't do anything. It was more of just an experience, you can say.
Okay, see, when people preface a memory like that, you know it's not good. Experience? What does that even mean?
No, it's not bad. It's kind of cute and a little bit funny. It was during the pandemic, and you were playing your way through The Last of Us Part 2.
Oh, okay. Okay. That wasn't me. That was definitely Sammo.
So, listeners, Ammo was so scared about this one bit.
You know, that was Sammo. You don't want to hear about this. This is boring. You came here to learn about death in video games.
No. It's super relevant to this episode. So, Ammo was on this level where you're trapped in this dark office with a pack of super fast, sneaky zombies. And he was so scared that he had to video call me so that I could keep him company while he played through it.
Okay, so I knew you were bored. Everyone was indoors, so I was just checking on a friend.
Sure, my friend. Absolutely. I think my favorite bit was once you beat that section and you were so confident, and when another zombie just broke out of that wall, you absolutely shat yourself and just ended the call.
That was connection issues, trust me. It was a spotty time for the internet.
What was it that actually scared you as compared to, say, a horror movie?
Well, in that instance, it was obviously a jump scare. Jump scares get me all the time, even in movies. But I think it's different with games because it's interactive, right? In a horror movie, you can look away and the character's going to keep on doing whatever they're doing. In video games, you are literally in their shoes making the movements for them. So then whatever's trying to kill them is trying to kill you, which is much scarier.
Right. And projecting yourself on the video game character is much easier to do, which in horror games might make it more stressful. But in cases of, say, grief, loss, or emotion, it makes video games a fantastic medium for storytelling and expression, right?
Exactly.
Exactly indeed. So today we'll be taking a look at how some video games discuss the concept of death, dying, grief, and beyond. Though weirdly, for our examples, we both pretty much picked indie games, didn't we?
Yep, we did. Death in indie games is what we should have called this one.
We didn't even mean to. We just asked each other and the first thing that came to our minds was a few games from independent developers.
Yep. But I'd say with a lot of things that we cover on this show, we're pretty sure we'll come back to this in later seasons. There's just too many, you know, examples of death, grief in popular media. It's a content goldmine, basically.
That it is. Before we jump in, would you consider yourself a gamer?
Yeah, 100%. For most people, movies and music is their first passion. For me, it was games. And you know how much of a movie buff I am, too. So that means a lot. What about you?
I would say definitely when I was in high school, like think Call of Duty, Halo, GTA, basically first-person shooters.
Oh, okay. So you were basically a Call of Duty bro. That's amazing.
That's so
good. Did you like brag about having sex with people's mothers on Xbox Live as well? That was the thing back in the day.
Oh God, no, that was definitely not me. I wasn't a first-person shooter bro for a long time. Thankfully, I discovered the world of fantasy and adventure RPGs and never really looked back. Well, occasionally, but my heart is with RPGs.
Well, speaking of looking back, I think that before we go into our examples of games that will explore death and grief, let's actually go back to the concept of death within the lens of gaming.
That is a fantastic idea. But does that mean it's time for a mansplaining moment again?
Oh, only if I can do an impression while doing it.
Oh, okay. As who?
That's for our listeners to guess.
Oh man, okay. Listeners, let us know who you think this is, and we'll give you a jar with a single tear from Ammo.
So hypothetically, if I were to discuss the concept of death in video games, I would then have to look at the medium of video games itself. Then hypothetically, the Xbox and the PlayStation, or as I call it, the wet ass P word, you would then have to find video games as machines in an arcade, right?
So and we're going to go back to ammo because that was a lot. And I think you need to take a little bit of a breath, my friend.
Yeah. So we would find video games as machines in arcades, right? Back in the day. Therefore, they needed a way to make children spend as much money as possible. Enter the concept of lives or death in video games. That's basically just the number of attempts that you get at the video game before you have to pay more money. Now, if little Timmy back in the 80s loses all his lives, his progress and all his high score gets lost. So now he's going to guilt his mummy and daddy into more change, which goes directly into the arcade's piggy bank.
That was very well said. Also very terrifying to hear, but very well said. Once games moved out of arcades and directly into the person's home, it's interesting how much of the concept of running out of lives carried into modern gaming, where quote-unquote death or spending money to play games, again, isn't really an issue.
Totally, yeah. And I think there's a bunch of reasons for this. Like, is death being used as a gameplay mechanic to guide or even punish players for playing a certain way? Also, like in any medium that relies on a story, death creates a sense of something at stake narratively. So it's quite convenient for that. Another thing that I think we all overlook is that it could be one of the key appeals of video games itself. Like having the freedom to jump off a building in GTA and not have a permanent death, like the real world. It's, I guess, all part of the escapism of video games.
Yeah, like each story or universe, depending on whatever game you're playing, is this playground for you to explore and experiment in, knowing that there isn't going to be any harm to your actual physical body.
Not yet. So wait until they perfect things like haptic feedback vests and stuff. Then when you get punched in a video game, you'll probably feel something in real life.
Sounds very dystopian and also very much Ready Player One.
Well, we're millennials and everything is dystopian. Plus, it's not like a real punch. It'll be like a vibration.
That's 100% going to end up being used for porn, isn't it?
Well, considering that it took literally no time for porn to venture into VR, yeah, I'd say so.
By the way, fun fact, in 2019, I got the high score in Mrs. Pac-Man in one of those arcade gaming bars downtown. Truly one of my best accomplishments.
Mrs. Pac-Man? Ms. Pac-Man? I forget. In any case, I think it's really interesting that the first female protagonist in gaming goes all the way back to that, like, early 80s.
Yeah, my Tinder date at the time was both very impressed and equally terrified at my level of dedication and commitment to the game and to reach the high score.
I can imagine.
I also think it's fascinating how the concept of arcade bars are bringing back this old school social gaming aspect.
Yeah, well, it's not just arcade bars. It's the entire indie game scene has been embracing retro gameplay mechanics and visuals for some years now.
Okay, so one of the videos we watched to prepare for this episode was a really interesting video on YouTube titled The Paradox of Death in Video Games.
We'll link it in the show notes, of course.
In one example, it breaks down how deaths in modern games are often portrayed as more gruesome, with close-up shots to encourage an emotional response from the player to signify the gravity of their character dying. The reality is that no one actually died, and the player knows this, so developers often try to elicit these emotions by being more visual and more graphic.
That makes total sense. You have to override our learned suspension of disbelief, right? And appeal to our monkey brains? Visceral gore works pretty well for that, I'm sure. Just off the top of my head, some examples of that. Last of Us, obviously. There's also things like Resident Evil, Tomb Raider, Dead Space, Mortal Kombat.
Oh, yeah. And beyond the idea of eliciting a reaction through gore, you already talked about death as a narrative driver or even as a punishment. Some games go further than just having you go back to where you die and making you redo a bunch of stuff. There are also some games where when you die, you're brought down an entire experience level. It seems like the punishing type of games are super hot right now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're thinking Zombie U, DayZ, We Happy Few, and there's a bunch of others.
And then not to mention Dark Souls.
Oh, man. The entire Souls-like genre is based on the concept of you will die, right? These games I think the developer's called From Software. They're designed to be as difficult as punishing and as unfair as possible. So, you know, continued deaths are part of the learning curve. It's a really interesting take on death if you remove it from the video game aspect in a way. It's kind of like Rebirth.
Another key point from this analysis is how morality relates to death, like how we've talked about it before in our Death in Disney episode.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many games, even if you may not die often or frequently, you know, you could be responsible for the death of other characters in the game's narrative, you know, like games where you have to decide where who lives or dies or something.
Or even just background people like civilians, NPCs. So the deaths themselves may not be graphic, but the choices presented to you leave you with kind of a moral dilemma. I still stand firm. You can tell a lot about a person based on how they treat NPCs. For anyone listening that doesn't play games, that means non-playable character.
Yeah, and I feel like the same kind of people who mindlessly murder NPCs in games, they're the same kind of people who'll be rude to service staff.
Oh my gosh, yeah. That Venn diagram is a circle.
And it's kind of interesting because as we were putting this episode together, we noticed that it seems since like 2020 and the pandemic that we've seen more and more games come out that are specifically about death and grief, right? So these games aren't just using death as a mechanic. Death and grief is part of the narrative of the game.
Yeah, totally. At the end of 2019, GameSpot actually coined a piece titled "A Little Death Positivity in Games Can Be Good," where it basically calls out why it's important for video games to call out death and that death is a reality for everyone. Little did they know that the world would see a lot more death in a few months when COVID-19 started.
Yep, and also it's mostly the indie developers, right? That's the smaller independent studios that are tackling the tough questions and conversations because they don't have shareholders that would be scared away by topics like that.
So that perfectly brings us to this episode.
Yep. Listeners, we'll be covering some recent and popular indie games that revolve around death and grief.
Ammo, which game will you be covering?
Ooh, okay. So I'll be talking about Limbo, which was developed by Playdead.
Nice. I'll be taking a look at Mortician's Tale, which was developed by Laundry Bear Games.
There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it.
Yep. And one note for listeners to keep in mind, we'll try to make sure we don't spoil too much of these games for you, but please keep in mind there will likely be spoilers ahead.
Duh.
So, Limbo, tell me about it.
Limbo is a traditional party game where the aim is to pass forwards under a low bar without falling or dislodging a Oh, wait, that's the other kind of limbo. Whoops.
You never miss a beat, do you?
All right. So, I first played the video game Limbo back in 2010 when it first came out. Limbo is a special case because it's considered one of those games that started the indie game boom of the 2010s. It was made by a tiny studio. It's super short, like a couple of hours long, and it's really simple. It's basically a black and white 2D platformer. I think the actual term is 2.5D because there's like pseudo 3D perspectives with the background and stuff. It's almost like paper cutouts casting shadows onto a wall or something. But the aesthetics also uses like grainy film effects and minimal ambient sounds. And the result is that there's like this really super eerie atmosphere that's kind of associated with things like horror, like film noir or like German expressionism. This small little game from a small studio blew up. It was the talk of the industry when it came out. And then in the decade that followed, indie smaller games like it really started to carve out a place of their own in the gaming world.
Well, I mean, based off of the images I've seen, I can see why. So what exactly is it about?
Well, that's the thing. In a staple indie game narrative kind of thing, the real story of Limbo is what you can pull from the setting and some really minor hints. There's one main objective, but it's like purposefully vague.
Vague. Or we can say it's ammo, trying to be mysterious and fish for replies. Vague?
No, it's just regular vague, the better one.
Okay, gotcha. You've just pulled an ammo is quite literally a phrase our group of friends uses, by the way, listeners, when it comes to ammo doing things. So
yes. All right, so Limbo, you play basically as a featureless boy, say for his eyes you can see. He wakes up alone in a forest. He has to traverse through dangerous environments, puzzles, traps, and there's a giant spider chasing him all the time. The main objective is just to find your sister. Similar to what we were talking about before, you're encouraged to actually die, you know, and fail a few times before finding the correct solution.
Okay. Little details are all coming together. I got it.
So even with it being so simple, the combination of all these elements really create a unique aesthetic and atmosphere. And it was one of those games that had reviewers, you know, having the conversation of whether games are an art form in itself.
Okay, I can see how it could have taken off. Okay.
Yeah, when you start the game, you have no idea who you are. You have no idea how you got there, or really where you're going. You just know that you're trying to find your sister, and you just have to move from the left of the screen to the right to the next kind of zone.
Yeah, I remember when I did a quick playthrough, there was like no health bar from what I remember, right? And it's pretty much you're either alive or you're not, like there's no in between. One hit and then poof, done. You're donezo, you're dead.
Exactly. The devs actually called this style of play Trial and Death.
Oh, that is very fitting. They picked a very good name.
But this doesn't sound very deathy so far, I hear you ask. But it's implied, and nowadays, you know, we're 10 years on, more than that, it's more universally understood that the game Limbo is actually about Limbo, the place you go when you die, as seen through a child's eyes.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I can see that.
Take the name of the game, for example. In Dante's Inferno, Limbo is basically the first circle of hell. We use the word Limbo now to describe that in-between place between death and life. The word itself, limbo, is taken from the Latin limbus, meaning edge. Edge of life, hell, heaven. Well, that's up to you.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that checks out. Also, like, taking the edge off of something. But anyways, right? On.
And there's, like, dozens of core theories out there about what the actual meaning of the game is. You know, each with huge video essays and thousands of believers for each theory. And the devs are purposefully really coy about what the real narrative is, which I kind of like, because that way you can infer your own interpretation.
Ooh, I love a good theory.
Well, the theories are taken just from what the game gives you, right? So you know you have to find your sister. In some of the levels, like there's a bit with a sort of a rickety treehouse. There's a bit with a crashed car. The most popular theory is that this boy and his sister are in an accident. So let's say they fall out of that treehouse or they get into a car accident or both. Some people think that the car accident happens as the two children are being driven to the hospital following the collapse of the treehouse.
This is the worst luck I have ever heard. Oh my gosh. Oh, it's
about to get worse because the theories are all about how following this accident, the boy is in limbo in the afterlife trying to get to his sister, who might already be dead, or she's fine and the boy's trying to come back to life. And then there's another group of people who think that all of this is happening as he's asleep in a coma, following an accident, obviously.
This is so like dark and complex, yet told in a cool, yet weirdly sweet and compassionate and empathetic way. I don't even know. There's so much going on.
It is. And the main sort of enemy of the game, a giant spider, chases you and you have no defense. You can only run away. So, you know, could this spider be a symbol of this boy's fears? If he's in hell or limbo or, you know, even a coma, the spider could be death or the devil coming to claim his soul. You know, the game does a really good job of using the atmosphere to imply that you're somewhere otherworldly. And it's such a like incredible atmospheric, but like lonely experience.
You know, as an artist, I think that art should make you feel a certain way and ask questions about the world around you. And it sounds as if Limbo does that perfectly.
Oh, totally. And as you progress, the danger and the pace of the game ramps up. And the further through the levels you get, the less natural the setting gets. So when you first wake up in the game, you start off in a forest. And as you progress, things get more and more sort of urban and dystopian. And then obviously you've got this giant spider ambushing you at certain moments. And that then makes some of the puzzles you're trying to complete, much more urgent.
Now, that's interesting. The idea of each circle of hell or limbo, for a lack of better term, kind of pushing you further. And then the further you go, the more human-made the settings get. Like the sins of man?
Could be, yeah.
Human? I don't know.
But with that, or he's, you know, could be getting closer to the real world and about to wake up or come back to life or whatever.
I can see people getting into super heated arguments over this.
Oh, and that's exactly what's been happening in the comment section of these YouTube video essays for like over a decade now. And speaking of conflict, there's hardly any other people in the game. So those that you do run into, either they run to attack you, they run away, or you already find them dead or close to death.
Like lost souls.
Like lost souls in limbo, yeah. There's also a lot of religious symbolism in it for sure. So when you finish the game and the character's journey ends, it basically, you know, you start back at the forest again, repeating the same journey as you start a new game.
Oh, look at that. Rebirth making a reappearance.
Exactly. Honestly, it sounds like it. Just repeating life repeatedly, hoping for a different outcome. Sounds like all of us, really.
So you mentioned other theories. Any of note?
Oh, man, there's so many. There's obviously the coma, the limbo death theory, you know, what actually happened, the treehouse or the crash. People have also like spiritually linked it to other media. So maybe it's like a reimagining of a story, you know, or a film. The community just keeps on giving.
This is so interesting. What a wonderful journey to embark on.
Oh, yeah. And for anyone who's a fan of Limbo, the developers, Playdead, released their second game, which is a spiritual sequel of sorts. It's called Inside, and it came out in 2016.
Oh, have you played it?
I haven't played it myself, but I'm going to check it out if you want to come back to it.
Nice. I'll add it to one of my growing lists of games to play.
You have multiple lists of growing games?
I have so many things I need to do that I have not done. Don't remind me of anything, please.
All right, let's get on to your game next.
Have I told you that as a child, I wanted to become a coroner?
I think that's actually one of the things I learned through doing the show. It's so on brand for both of us, actually, because, you know, there's this, and my teachers were always worried about my gory drawings. So regular five-year-olds who wanted to become astronauts and princesses, but not us.
Not us. Look at us now. Who would have thought? Obviously, I was forced to face the concept of death and dying from an early age. I was obsessed with true crime shows as a kid.
Like every white woman now is, yep.
Yep. I love it when you pass off your experience on dating apps as actual data.
Hey, my lived experience has a lot of value.
To criminal psychologists, yes, maybe for sure. Didn't you grow up on beheading videos and video games?
Okay, that's what I get for interrupting your bit. That's fair.
So, as a kid, I loved true crime, but especially the bits about what the body told people about how the person lived and died. So, fast forward to now, that's kind of still the case. So, when I recently heard about a game called Mortician's Tale, I knew I had to dissect it for this episode. Get it? Did you get it? Did you laugh? Did you giggle?
Dissect? Nice. You had to autopsy what the fuss was about.
Precisely.
All right, Mortician Maria, let's hear it.
So much like your choice, this is an indie game. And this game is also a short one. It's about an hour long. If you're not a gamer, you can actually find people playing through the full game on YouTube. That's how short it is. It takes place in a funeral home. The character you play is a mortician working there. The game itself is heavily inspired by the book Smoke Gets in Your Eyes by Caitlin Doughty.
Caitlin Doughty, that sounds familiar.
Yes, I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. But they are known for the organization The Order of a Good Death and her series titled Ask a Mortician on YouTube.
There it is. Yep, I know her.
There's no doubt that you do. So the game itself is praised as a definitive death-positive game. And as you play, you'll see why.
It's quite the claim, a definitive death positive game. I'm kind of picturing it as a simulator game. So the game revolves around organizing and managing a mortician's funeral home.
Kind of. Well, I know you love your sim games, but this one is more story driven. You play as a mortician who is responsible for preparing the bodies for viewing and burials, and also navigating different family dynamics while doing so.
Family dynamics?
Yes. So your story is basically moved forward by missions or tasks sent to you via email that you need to read every day. Some emails come from friends, some come from the director of the funeral home, and others, the hearse driver. Some emails outline exactly how the deceased person or their families wants the body to be processed. Like, that depends on the death, open or closed casket, presentations. But other elements depend on the requests from the deceased or their family, according to different cultures and things like that.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. This game is a super engaging narrative, but it also teaches about different cultural practices that take place at the time of death and how they prepare the body for burial. And you learn it all firsthand by doing it.
I've got to check it out. I can imagine it's going to be like a Green Burial episode where it gives you this mini mind-blowing moment, you know, encouraging you to contemplate what you want with your body once you're dead.
Totally. I mean, I would say that the whole dead mom thing has done that for me, but alas, this game is also on that list.
Well, that's fair.
And you're still uncomfortable with the dead mom jokes. I love it.
Well, yeah, because you just throw them out like a Yu-Gi-Oh card.
That's kind of the point. You're so rarely speechless that I'll take every chance I can get to make you be quiet.
Why does everyone say that to me? Anyway, the game.
Okay, so the game. How familiar are you with it?
Not very. So, like I said, I know of Caitlin Doughty and the book the game's inspired by, but that's it. So when we were researching for this episode, you brought it up. I checked out some stuff online. So, you know, when you're walking around it, it looks like one of those old school isometric games. So it's 3D. It looks 3D, but it's on a 2D sort of axis. And then you're in the morgue, you're doing your thing. It looks like a more, it kind of looks like the board game Operation.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it kind of does. I mostly focused my research more on kind of like the narrative and gameplay and what it all means. But yeah, like the visual elements of the game are also so key. So thanks for like highlighting that. When you're not running around the funeral home or morgue or checking your emails and tasks, you are preparing the bodies. The game shifts into the sort of point and drag type of game. The deceased is on the table and all of your tools are on the side, a top-down view, kind of almost like POV, some can say. You have the different embalming tools, needles, makeup, etc., and you have to do it all in the right order to make it right. Some things you might not use on the body, whereas other ones you will.
It gets pretty hands-on.
Right. But the art direction very much stayed away from the realism aesthetic and more focused on an approachable cartoon art style for the characters and the environment. There's also lots of purple in this game. Everyone is obviously wearing black, but a lot of the spaces you travel and the interfaces you use are different shades of purple. So if you are a fan of purple and black, A Mortician's Tale has the aesthetic just for you.
They knew what they were doing. Anyone who's playing a game called A Mortician's Tale is going to like black and purple. Come on.
It's smart. It also ties in really nicely with the overall mood and feel of the game.
Yeah, like that kind of muted, almost cartoony art style makes it so that the parts with the bodies aren't too graphic, which I can understand can be kind of triggering for some people.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I think that means the game doesn't get rated as harshly for use of gore, lowering the age restriction. So then that makes it more accessible to people.
Oh, yeah, good point. I knew your video game industry knowledge would shine in this episode. I also think that the short length really helps the game too. But for me, the key thing is how can you approach the realities of death and dying in a way that isn't triggering or crude, that also makes it accessible to teach younger people about it? Because that's what this is all about, really. If everyone I had encountered as a kid had learned death positivity from an earlier age, my grieving process would have been so much smoother and their lives would have been so much better too.
Yeah, and this goes back to what we said recently. It's not kids or people in general that are the issue. It's the way that we make teaching so unengaged and results-based.
Exactly. And the balance of engaging gameplay, interesting characters and interactions, and an overall respectful tone is really what makes Mortician's Tale special, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So the game is obviously focused on some pretty heavy stuff. And a part of it, you know, being able to process dead bodies is kind of bold. But the way you're saying it makes it sound like it handles it pretty well.
Yeah. Part of the game, as you read the emails, you read what relatives of the deceased have to say about their loved one, even just in these tiny bits of interactions via email, it does a really good job of establishing an emotional connection between you and this deceased and their family. You can't help but feel a sense of compassion and almost connection. And it makes you think about their lives and connections before this little window of time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then after learning all of that, you have to process the body, which deliberately brings this feeling of heaviness, or almost, I guess, kind of like a somber moment, because they were a person with these complex, beautiful relationships with the people you just spoke to. And here they are on a table in front of you. It kind of forces you to face the reality of the situation. It's quite beautiful.
That's a hallmark of a well-made game, man. Like being able to connect to the characters and using that connection to create drama and conflict. Both games we're looking at today do have a sort of bare bones, more unique and subtle approach to storytelling, but it completely works. You know, there are multi-million dollar AAA games out there that have super convoluted stories that just don't hit because you don't care about the characters and what's happening.
And here are these two smaller developers, David and Goliath style, totally kicking asses because they have narratives that make you feel and learn things, right?
Totally.
So some of the family dynamics, as in real life, are a bit more complicated and strained, which comes out in the emails, obviously. As you said, what's a great story without some conflict, right? So for example, there are some instances where the wishes of the deceased are different than the wishes of the living, and you're kind of stuck in this moment of an ethical dilemma. This kind of opens up the player to scrutinize these moments and wrestle with their limited agency over the circumstances.
Oh, tough choices. I can imagine being pulled between respecting the wishes of the deceased or offending their family. Again, this can act as a catalyst for people to think about their family dynamics in real life. So would you talk to your family about this stuff and make sure that everything is in writing about what you want done to you when you're dead?
Yeah, absolutely. Like one of the circumstances involves someone who dies by suicide and you're asked if you're okay processing the body because the person wanted to be cremated, but the family refused that final wish. Do you handle the body or do you refuse?
Oh man, that's heavy.
Yep, absolutely. But that's kind of the point again.
So on the ethical conflict side, what else is there? Because I imagine there's a ton on this side with the family dynamics and all of that, especially since it's based in reality.
Well, one other example is one that we've actually touched on and mentioned in a previous episode. One email that you received discusses the unethical treatment and misgendering of a trans person after they have died and how the forms and procedures that are put in place do not appropriately accommodate or support them even after death. We talked about dead naming and funerals back in season one, episode 4.
Mm. So one thing that stands out from what I'm hearing is you're making the player face these ethical decisions, but it's also to some degree calling out the industry itself.
Yep. As we know, death has been around since, well, the existence of life. But as we mentioned in our Green Burial episode recently, our current practices and processes with bodies are lacking when it comes to providing ethical treatment to marginalized people. To me, the game itself also helps to show why the death industry escapes so much reform and accountability as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like with a lot of things we discuss, you won't go through the situation until you have to go through it, because we don't talk about it beforehand.
And by the time you're going through it, you're kind of preoccupied with all the other things going on to really notice the impacts of the situation is having on you and your loved ones.
Hmm. So a mortician's tale is asking you, hey, how do you want to be treated when you die? Is that written down somewhere? Is it agreed? Because there are people, even loved ones, who might not agree with that.
That's the big conversation. And my biggest takeaway from looking into the game.
It's fascinating. I'm going to bump that up to the top of my list. Move out of the way, Goat Simulator 3.
Oh my gosh. Honestly, as I've said, YouTube is a great resource for non-gamers to access the experience of gaming without whatever it is that stops them from gaming. Check out A Mortician's Tale, I urge you. It is absolutely brilliant. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Oh, that's a good one. We're putting that on a shirt too, TED Talk. Okay, so we've taken a brief but really insightful dive into two indie video games that explore death, dying, and grief. How are we wrapping this one up? Old Reliable?
Old Reliable indeed. Wheel of Misfortune.
Of course, as is tradition, for listeners that don't know, we like to end our episodes with a friendly little head-to-head between Maria and I to see who's learned the most.
Sure, friendly. I take the title of top thanatologist very seriously, I'll have you know.
Well, it's friendly for one of us, at least. You want to give it a spin?
Spin, spin, spin! Look at that! It's landed on trivia. Grab a question and lay it on me.
Gladly. So, taking it back to the beginning of the episode, what real-life purpose did death originally serve in gaming?
Oh, like arcade games type of thing, right? Good old capitalism. To force kids to keep putting money into the game and maintain their high score. Final
yep,
answer.
Exactly. Yep. Gotta love emotionally manipulating kids and their parents into giving their hard-earned cash. Your turn.
Okay. So this one is about the From Software game you mentioned earlier. It's a Souls-like game, Elden Ring. The game that heavily revolves around the player dying and experimenting in new ways to beat bosses and getting around.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, indeed. Now, bearing in mind, this is a more recent game. It was actually released in February 2022. As of March 2023 article from GameRant, how many times had players died? Is it 9 million? 90 million? 9 billion or 19 billion?
How am I supposed to know that?
Listen, I don't make the questions. I just read them, man.
Well, yeah, but I'm just guessing at this point. That's unfair because your question was about something I actually said.
I thought this was friendly head-to-head ammo. Remember? What is... Hello?
Okay. All right. Wait, what were the options?
Okay, so how many times have Elden Ring players died in total as of March 2023? This is a ridiculous question. Is it 9 million, 90 million, 9 billion, or 19 billion?
Well, look, from what I know about Dark Souls and Elden Ring, it's got to be a lot. Anything that From Software makes is brutal to the player, like borderline masochistic. But the game's only like a year old, so it can't be that high.
Right? Listen, we're going to need a friendly answer, sir.
All right, well, I'm going to go with 90 million, but that still seems kind of high to me.
Well, nope. It's actually 9 billion.
No way is it 9 billion. No shot. That's insane.
Right? 9 billion. 90 billions deaths in this game.
That's got to be a lot of frustrated gamers.
And a lot of rage quitting, broken controllers.
So, wait, there are more player deaths in this year-old game than there are people on the planet right now.
From Software doesn't pull punches. You want to beat the game? Be prepared to die. A lot.
9 billion deaths within a year. Wow.
I'll read this from the article. So, quote, those who have played Elden Ring and have experienced death after death may be interested to know just how many fans have met their demise. Some recent statistics published by Bandai Namco show that there have been over 9 billion player deaths in Elden Ring since the game launched in February 2022. A breakdown shows that 69% of these were from enemies and other NPCs. 15% were due to status effects such as poisoning. 14% were caused by the player falling to their death, while just 2% were caused by another player.
I love that we live in an era where we have stats like this.
Me too, man, me too. Okay, your question, go.
Okay. In Limbo, who or what is generally considered to be the main antagonist? And this isn't multiple choice either. You're on your own this time.
the antagonist is existential human dread, I guess? Or like, I don't know.
I mean, that's it's not the answer I was looking for, but you're not wrong.
It's either that or like that giant spider thing, right? Like, no thanks. That sounds terrifying.
Correct. Yeah. Giant spider. And especially since you have no defense, it's relentless.
Well, I can see why people think that spider represents death or even trauma. So we've got time for one last question from me.
Sure. By the way, I hope the listeners are keeping score because we get so caught up in the questions, we always forget to keep score.
Right? Like, also, what question are we on? But anyways, it doesn't matter. We'll do our standard final quiz at the end of the season and winner will take all.
Rendering all of this kind of pointless, really.
Isn't it all pointless, Mr. Nihilist?
It's Mr. Existential Nihilist, so no, not all of it. Just the overwhelming majority of it.
So, final question. This one is to remind you and everyone listening about which book A Mortician's Tale is based on and to check it out. So, which book by Caitlin Doughty is the video game A Mortician's Tale based on?
All right, so whenever we do this and you give me facts or whatever, I'm always thinking, remember that ammo, that's the one, that's going to be the one thing that shows up in trivia. And then I forget. I swear, I'm listening and I'm learning, but I can't remember everything, all right?
Want to try and guess?
I'm completely blanking here.
The answer is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes.
Oh my... You know what? I should have remembered that because when you said it first, I was like, oh, that's what the pilot episode of Mad Men is called.
Oh my gosh.
And then my brain was like, yes, use that for trivia. And then I didn't.
And then you forgot. That's the one thing you tried not to do.
Yep.
Hello,
must be all these...
ADHD. Sorry. ADHD.
Yep. Must be all these video games rotting my brain, huh?
So before we end this episode, I want to go back to what we said about covering more games. I'm currently playing through a game called Hades. Please go check it out. It's the newest one that I'm working my way through, and it is top tier. We've got a huge list of games and media about death and grief to cover for future episodes and seasons. But with games, we could always play them together and maybe record that as an episode or even as a live stream.
Now that's an idea. Powerful.
So if that's something that you'd like to see, let us know. And while you're at it, what are your thoughts on these games? Have you played them before? What are your Limbo theories or your Mortician's Tales experiences?
Are there any games you wish we would have covered?
Let us know on our socials at PhilotimoLife. That's PhilotimoLife.
Until next time, it's goodbye from Ammo. That's me. And it's goodbye from Maria.
That's me. But this goodbye doesn't have to be forever.
Have a good one.
Bye.